merger is between July 1st and September 1st, then it's considered, the merger is considered to be completed as of June 30th, so that it applies to the whole fiscal year, even though it takes place a little bit after the beginning of the fiscal
year. So that doesn't substantially affect the engrossed bill?
No.
Just the clarification. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Williams.
Didn't we have some testimony from one of the places where they'd had the small high schools, and there was a, they were going to have a loss of revenue as a result of the consolidation? I don't remember who it was, though. Was it Yonkawa?
Yeah, that was the purpose of the consolidation provision in the bill in itself, in the first
right.
place.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. And did you mention the A7s?
I did not.
Okay.
To 819?
Yes.
Let's see. I think that was Representative Crummell's.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to clarify what we've got in front of us. Okay. So, but again, my intent is not to move this today, but I want to keep these bills in front of us. Because we will have to move them at some point here, and I don't want to have to start from scratch when we are ready to do that. But I think today, Representative Farr, did you want to bring up the A7s while we're in work session?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move the A7 amendments to Senate Bill 819.
Okay. Representative Farr moves the A7 amendments to Senate Bill 819. Let's have discussion on that. Representative Farr, do you want to speak to that?
Well, it's... you know, we have a little bit of disparity both on the high end and the low end in the high schools in the state. And when school districts are growing beyond the capacity of the state to fund them correctly, I think we should recognize that. And the A7 amendments would indeed recognize that.
Further discussion on the A7s? Yes.
I certainly appreciate the goal of what that amendment tries to address. But when you deal with one school district at the expense of everyone else, I think there's an inherent unfairness. There's other high-growth school districts who would also love to have a tweak made that would help out their situation. So while I'm sympathetic to what they're trying to get at, it helps that school district and that school district only. And I think if we're going to deal with that issue, we should do it in a larger sense that helps either all high-growth school districts or helps the formula be more fair altogether or, does it in a way that that helps bring everybody up instead of one school district up.
Thanks. Representative Berger?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm just... not willing to discuss high-growth schools until we can discuss declining enrollment at the same time. I think we have two critical issues in Oregon, and I believe that we need to look at them in one discussion as to how we're going to handle all the total state as far as school districts are concerned, because both issues are very, very serious to those schools that are experiencing it. And I'm as sympathetic with the high growth as I am declining enrollment, but I'm only willing to discuss them at one time.
Okay. Anybody else? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've listened carefully, and I haven't heard the key point yet. And the key point, of course, is that the ADMW is underfunded statewide. And that when we get, if and when we ever get an adequate school budget to actually pay the real costs of educating our children, these kinds of issues disappear.
All right. Representative Thompson. Are you recording this, Kathy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, will be a no vote on this, and I have great compassion for Sherwood, and I'm very impressed with their community support. But I agree with everything that Representative Berger said. In addition, one of the factors that was put out very strongly to us on the emails that we've received is that Sherwood is the most underfunded or the lowest funding school district in the state. And that is true, but let's not lose sight of the fact that our funding is also based on some adjustments due to unique student circumstances, be it ESL, special ed, and those kinds of things. And Sherwood has a very low representation, and that's one of the reasons for their low funding. I certainly don't deny that they need more money and that they are fast growing and those kinds of things, but I agree that we should look at it in the total picture because they're extenuating circumstances of all kinds. So I will be a no, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Representative Krimmel, are you here?
Yeah, there. Do you want to, you've already spoken eloquently and at length on these. Did you want to say anything more this morning before we go to the vote? Representative Farr, you were going to speak.
After Representative.
Okay, that's, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jerry Krimmel, State Representative, House District 26, which includes the Sherwood School District, and thank you very much for the courtesy. I would just point out, and I appreciate the comments from the committee, and I understand where Representatives Verger, Hobson, and Haas and Barnhart are coming from, but I think one of the things that needs to be recognized is that in addition to being a fast growth district and high growth district, is that it has been exceptionally high. It's not like some of the other districts that have had 1% and 2% sustained growth over a period of time, but this is a district that has had growth in 1 year as great as 10% and 12%, but has been sustained at greater than 4% over the course of the last 12 years. The other thing is that since equalization came into play, and I absolutely agree with you that the funding, state school funding formula is flawed. And it has been flawed from the very beginning. And maybe it was the best that we could get at the time. But the thing is that it is flawed, and we need to recognize that. But when you have a district like Sherwood that not only is having extremely fast growth, but the amount of money on a per-student basis has been declining steadily for the last 10 years. It has gone down every single year. So where they may have started out 10 years ago at receiving $5,100 or $5,200 on a per-student basis, they're now down to $4,500 on a per-student basis. And what you have is a train wreck about to happen. They have done very, very well, and there has been support in the community, but they have done very well at managing their resources and trying to avoid the train wreck. However, I don't think they are going to be able to avoid that any longer. Some of the steps that they've taken, for example, is that as they have teachers retire, they replace them with younger teachers. The problem is with the state's school funding formula, they don't get the advantage of the increased experience of their teachers. So those are some of the things that they're faced with, but to try to reduce their costs on a per-student basis, what they have actually done is they have a younger teaching force in place. So I appreciate you very much considering the A7 amendments, and I really would like to see the committee pass the A7s, but we will see where you go from here. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for the courtesy.
Thank you for your work on this, too. Appreciate you bringing this forward. Obviously, it's hard to do to solve one district's problem in the context of the state school fund, because every dollar that goes somewhere is a dollar that comes from some other district. And I know that folks that aren't steeped in the mechanics and the strange world of the state school fund, that seems odd. But with our limited dollars, that's just how it is. So I think that's what the committee is reflecting, probably, for the folks from Sherwood who are here today, that is being concerns about that. Nothing to against the Sherwood District in particular, but just recognizing the limitations within the fund and how the dollars move around within that. Representative Farr?
Just two quick points. I should declare a potential conflict of interest in that I grew up in Sherwood, although it was a different Sherwood. It was Sherwood Forest in England. That being said, we
Mr. Chair, I just point out that in like that, he's trying to rob from the rich. Nice connection there. Representative Robin Hood.
But we do have a history of favoring single school districts, including school districts represented by people on this panel. So I just don't see it being a problem to include Sherwood in this bill.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, sir. I agree with the concerns raised by Representative Krummel. I think they're very important concerns, and I think it's extremely difficult for a school district to operate on the basis of the funding that he's talking about. It's a very, very difficult task. Having been a member of a school board where the funding also was at the level that Sherwood had in the early 90s and has seen steady declines ever since, even though I don't think it's declined as far as Sherwood has, in a per-pupil basis, it is an enormous problem, and the kinds of programs that you can provide for children with the funds that are available, and as we continue to decline the state funding, are extremely limited and getting worse. And I one of these days soon, we're going to get to the point, I don't know when it's going to happen, but we will get to the point where the thing doesn't work anymore, period. And I'm not sure when that comes. It's actually, we've lasted a lot longer than I expected us to in this state. To try to broaden the perspective a bit, there are a whole lot of school districts in Oregon, not with the problem that Sherwood has in terms of high growth, but certainly with the problem that Sherwood has in terms of declining funds for funding the educational program. And I reiterate the comment I made a few minutes ago in the context of this additional statement. I think the solution to the problem, the real solution to the problem, is to figure out how to get the per pupil funding up in the state to the point where it ought to be, so that we can actually pay for the programs that students need, not just in Sherwood, but in all the districts in the state.
Okay. If that's the discussion, the extent of it, let's take a call on, this is on the amendment, just on the A7. Kathy?
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Berger?
No.
Barr?
Yes.
Kraft?
No.
Hobson?
No.
Scott?
Yes.
Berger?
No.
Williams?
Yes.
No. Well, how does that take it? That's 6-3. The motion fails. So the Ash A7s are not adopted into the bill. But again, Representative Crum, I appreciate you bringing this forward and your hard work on behalf of the district.
Thank you for your consideration.
You bet. Okay. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 819. And open a work session on Senate Bill 550. We have a new amendment on this. Steve, you could bring us up to date on this as well before we go too far.
Okay, member, Senate Bill 550, Ian Gross, you have before you. As the original bill, it deals with primarily two topics. One is the high-cost disabilities account. It transfers $12 million of state school fund dollars into the high-cost disabilities account, and then it makes a high-cost disability grant available to school districts as part of the school equalization formula. The funds would be used to pay the approved special education costs that exceed four times the per student general operating revenue in the school formula. So that amount would fluctuate depending on the appropriation level to the fund. And then if the costs that are eligible exceed the $12 million, they would be prorated so that the total would not exceed $12 million. So that's the first topic. The second deals with high-cost transportation districts. It calculates the amount of transportation costs per weighted student, and then ranks the district. The 10% highest cost then would have their transportation grant increased from 70% to 90% of approved cost. The next highest 10% would have their transportation grant increased from 70% to 80%. So that's the high-cost transportation provisions. And then as part of the high-cost disabilities grant, it repeals the out-of-state disabilities placement fund as of January 1, 2004. And if there's any remaining balance in that fund, it would revert to the state school fund. So the out-of-state disabilities cost would then be funded out of the new high-cost disabilities grant provisions. Okay, there's the A7 amendment. There was a proposal to change the high-cost disabilities grant such that the grant would apply to the cost above $25,000 per student rather than the amount within the formula for the general operating cost. So it would set that at a fixed amount at $25,000, And then it would also sunset the provisions at the end of this biennium, so that the high-cost disabilities grant would go away at that time. But and as part of that process, it does not restore the high-cost out-of-state disabilities fund, so that would continue to not exist after the end of this biennium. Yeah, I think that's the and the amendment replaces the bill, so mm-hmm. it's much longer than the new additional language. So it's all of the language that's in the bill plus the changes for the high cost disabilities care. Sure. Okay, the A9. Deals with the small high school merger language, essentially the merger language that you saw for Senate Bill 819. This is an amendment that would put that language into 550. So, including the correction amendment that we talked about.
Chair, what's the purpose of doing that?
I think it's a placeholder in case 819, in case we have any problems with 819 down the road. I'm not planning on moving this in at this point. Yeah, that just that saves the small school piece under any circumstance.
Okay.
The next amendment is the A10-810 to Senate Bill 550. This is also the same language that was proposed for Senate Bill 819. It's the Portland Amendment and has the same provisions. So again, it would allow it to be placed into 550 instead of 819.
Okay. So we've seen that before.
Yes. And you have a new amendment, Senate Bill 550-A11, that was brought forward this morning. I've had a quick look at it.
Thank you.
It deals with the Department of Education making an agreement with the school district to put money into a lease payment fund, I believe, for an Indian tribe that has capital costs for improving their school facilities. And I do not know the source.
Michael Mason and Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, I think. Okay, yeah. Do you want to come up and tell us about the ALF?
Chair Shatterly and members of the Revenue Committee, my name is Michael Mason. I'm with Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon, and pleasure to be here again this session. The amendment that we're putting forward, and we appreciate your patience with this and interest, is part of the continuing saga of the reconstruction that needs to happen, the rebuilding of the Warm Springs Elementary School. This is a public school, part of the 509J school district out of Madras. And so I want that to be very clear. It's a situation where there's a very crowded, declining old Bureau of Indian Affairs building that's being used. And I think you've heard some about this already regarding another bill, but the Senate Bill 807. But all parties agree that this building needs to be replaced. The deal put forward by the school district is that the tribe pays for the construction of the new facilities, and that would have to be done through floating bonds, tribal backed bonds. Then the school district would lease the facilities and pay back half of the cost of construction, so that this would be 50-50 share between the tribe and the school district on building this public school. What you have in front of you would give the parties, the school district and the tribes, another tool for resolving this long overdue issue. We've had an agreement in place for over 2 years now to get this done. Initially, we were planning to open the new school this coming September. That clearly is not going to happen because construction has not started. As we speak, the parties are negotiating the lease agreement, and this funds diversion language is in the draft lease agreement. However, talking with the Department of Education, there's no authority to do this without legislative action. So we've been working with them on this language. Again, it's discretionary language. It doesn't require the department to do this. It doesn't require the parties to do it. But our bond counsel has opined, and he's worked with the tribe for many years, and we've had two successful bond issuances working with him, has opined that this provision is necessary to be able to sell the bonds. So for the elementary school construction. So again, it's a serious crisis, and we appreciate your indulgence and assistance in helping us to, you know, resolve it, have another tool to work with to be able to get this elementary school built.
Michael, how does this relate to the bonding off the federal impact funds that we did earlier? That was about the same school, wasn't it?
It's about the same school. Actually, this is a little more specific because we're talking about an agreement to do a lease that's already in place. Again, the lease agreement's not in place, but the agreement to do it is in place, specific to the elementary school. The impact aid bond would be related to a bond issued by the school district. Right, so it's a little different.
But did they work together?
They could. I mean, the school district could use the impact aid dollars under Senate Bill 807 to back bonds to build a school. That does give them another tool to work with. I don't see that happening with the elementary school. It could happen conceivably with the middle school, okay. Which the tribe would have ultimately liked to see because of their extremely high dropout rate around eighth grade.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairman.
Just for clarification, this only affects the Madras district and its relationship with the tribe. This doesn't affect school fund distribution otherwise or any other districts around the state.
Right. It's very narrow. It has to be a lease that's basically a lease payback sort of agreement. No one else has or has contemplated such a thing, and no other tribe has a public school currently operating or planned to be operating on reservation.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Representative Virgin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, 807 was the impact aid, and you were going to bond it, and there was an agreement with the school district. Are we talking about a different school from 807?
It's the same school district. It could be used for the elementary school. We don't see that happening at this point. We see that as likely to be used for a middle school, Senate Bill 807. The issue here is, and that, again, this comes up late in the process because the negotiations are occurring as we speak about this. So in the last 2 weeks, this provision came up and this issue arose, and we had bond counsel saying that we needed this. So that's why this comes up now.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. So. Anybody else, then? Questions for Mr. Mason? All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Shirley.
Also, we had to testify today. Henry Weens asked to come forward. Mr. Weens, do you want to speak to us about 550? Another issue, I guess. Is that right?
Yes. Chairman Shetterly and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to give you a little input this morning on Senate Bill 550. My remarks are very brief and pointed. They have to do with the calculation of the high costs. And my interest is in the consideration given to including or not ESD resources in these calculations on high-cost students. In Hillsboro, we're part of the Northwest Regional ESD, and we do use ESD resources to fund high-cost programs for students with disabilities. We use ESD resources to fund tuition slots in deaf, hard of hearing classrooms, autism classrooms, classrooms for emotionally disturbed students. I want to encourage the consideration of including ESD costs because I believe there may be an unintended consequence to not including them. There are economies of scale, of course, for the ESD to operate programs for low-instance students where we can join together with other Washington County and regional districts to provide services in a more economical way than to replicate these high-cost programs in each district. However, if the ESD resources were not used in this calculation, we would pretty much be forced into looking at using the available ESD resources for something other than the consortiums for these high-cost students. It would make more sense for us then to look at funding speech-language pathology services and the lower cost programs. That's doable, but it's a shake up and probably not the most economical way to deliver the services. To include ESD resources in your calculation would be consistent with the other reporting mechanism you have at the state level for special ed expenditures, which is our report. It's not even a report anymore, but an audited review of our maintenance of fiscal effort. Federal law requires that the states monitor whether or not a district expends the same amount of funds on special education from one year to the next. And in doing that calculation, you set up a database initiative 4 years ago now, I believe, where you can track our expenditures from the districts on special education. You do include ESD expenditures as well in that calculation, and your auditors then give us a report on whether or not we have maintained fiscal effort. So it would be consistent with that other measure you do. We also include ESD expenditures when we for those districts who apply for a cap waiver request, when we look at those costs on a district-wide basis that exceed the 2X funding that we're provided. So that was basically my input this morning, was to encourage you to consider the consequences of whether or not you include ESD revenues. I know that different ESDs make their resources available in different ways. In the Northwest Regional ESD, there are there's some revenue that's set aside as core services, but the great majority of the available resources are made available through service credits. And this is very real discretionary revenue for the school district. We may choose as a school district to convert the available service credits to transit dollars and actually collect up to 50% of available service credits twice a year as revenue. So this is a discretionary expenditure of funds that our district anyway chooses to use primarily for high-cost special education students.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Weens. Other questions for Mr. Weens? Representative Barnhart.
I take it, given what you said a minute ago, that most of the calculations that would be required with this change that you've suggested are already being done.
They are being done for the purposes of determining maintenance of fiscal effort, yes.
Right. So we're talking about relatively small changes in the record-keeping part with the changes you're suggesting.
I believe so.
Thank you.
See, I think that may relate to how the department defines approved costs, as to how clean that would be.
Representative Virgin.
Well, I have a question for Steve. And
yeah, sure, go ahead.
Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay. Steve, on the Dash 7's amendments, does it change the school finance distribution sheets that we receive?
The simulation 12? No, it does not.
That was
based upon 25,000.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Anything else for Mr. Weens? All right. We'll take your comments into consideration.
You.
I appreciate you coming forward today. Well, we're in work session on 5:50, and before I close it again, we'll not move the bill today. Does anybody else want to be heard on this, either in response to Mr. Weens' testimony or something else we haven't heard on this, but we need to? Okay.
Well,
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm a bit concerned, and maybe it's just because I've forgotten where we were on this, but I'm a bit concerned about the early sunset in the A7s, and I don't remember why that was done that way.
Steve, do you want to recall that to us?
Just a comment quickly. I think something like this really needs to have a somewhat longer sunset just to figure out whether it's going to work or not.
Yeah, I think the reasoning behind putting the sunset in was to have actual data after the program was in place for 2 years to look at in 05, and the sunset then would force the legislature to do that and having actual data to see if they want to revise that program, that grant process, the calculation. Mr. Rose proposed those, and I don't see him in the audience right now, too.
Well, one more question, then.
Where are you looking, Representative Barnhart?
Well, I think I'm looking on page 29.
Yeah, section 26.
Section 26 and 27.
Well, that's because this replaces the current, right? Isn't that right, Steve?
Yes, that language relates to the repeal of the Out-of-State Disabilities Placement Fund, and those two statutes are part of that.
Okay.
Fund.
So that is not a sunset on this bill. That is because that Out-of-State Disabilities Placement Fund right. is replaced by the bill in the A7.
So this bill doesn't have a sunset
no.
then? Okay, I misunderstood
yeah,
the earlier remarks. Thank you.
Is that right, Steve? I mean, I want to clarify. Right. I wanted to make sure that was
the bill does not have
yes. Okay.
Just that provision.
Right. It looks like a sunset, but that's because we're replacing that current fund.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
And I must have misheard what he said earlier.
But you're right. January 1, 2004 would be a very quick sunset.
Look at Section 3 on page 2. Which repeals Section 2 on July 1st, 2005.
We are on...
So Section 3 is the repeal of the high-cost disabilities.
All right. Mr. Chair. Okay. Representative Williams.
Just a question for Steve. Steve, early on May 7th on this bill, you gave us a Simulation 12 run. Mm-hmm. Is that Simulation 12 run still applicable to the Dash A7 amendments?
Yes, it is. And the reason it is that I did not have, well, one, I don't know what the amount would be for the general purpose grant because we don't know what the appropriation level is, but assuming that that would be close to, you know, $4,900, $5,000, then it would still... I didn't have that information available, so I used the $25,000 as proposed in the amendment for that simulation tool.
Okay. So I just wanted to make sure that that nothing had essentially changed with
right.
the A7 amendment that would have impacted the numbers in the simulation.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Berger?
Steve, to follow up on that, if looking at this run, this bill provides for winners and losers.
Always.
Can't be all winners.
Yes or no?
Yes, it does. Yes. I think there were something like 77 that received more and the balance received less.
Yeah.
Representative Barnhart?
And who the winners are and who the losers are will change from year to year based on where the high-cost students are.
Mm-hmm. Fine.
That's possible, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative?
That you could argue that there are winners and losers under the current system.
Or do you think he knew it?
Because of the disparity.
Yeah, that's right.
It's that disparity we're trying to fix.
Well, and I guess, yeah, to the extent there are winners and losers, I guess the counter-argument to that is that is because this more accurately reflects where those costs right. are that are not being met right now.
Right.
So you could say this redresses... current inequities in the formula, making winners out of losers.
Mr. Chair, if I could, it does seem like a Dash A7 amendment in a bill we just heard failed that was attempting to sort of do a very similar thing. So none of us ought to be too supremely rigid, I think, in our analysis of winners and losers when it comes to the school funding formula.
But the calculus changes when you have more than 10.
Touche.
That's right.
No, I think the calculus changes when you have 5 votes on the committee.
Okay, when you have more than 5. Oh, the pristine world of the school funding formula. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had to get in on that one, too. I think there are some real differences between the amendment that we just talked about and the one with high needs. Any district, and it could happen to anybody next year, that ends up with a $170,000 student in their district will immediately and not expectedly realize that situation.
Including potentially Sherwood.
Yeah.
Including potentially Sherwood.
Okay, well, this is why I didn't want to move this bill today. For those of you who haven't been on the Revenue Committee before, or haven't watched this before, don't be alarmed. These school funding bills always go like this, and sometimes they don't go. It was just that's just the way it is. Very hard, and I don't mind at all taking some time to get it done right. It's nothing we have to have done before sign or die, ultimately. So I'm happy to take some time to give some consideration to these. I know we did get some new input from Mr. Weems, and I'll ask staff to give some consideration to that if that's something that possibly can be addressed. And I'll be happy to hear your ongoing comments, committee, as to your concerns or interest in both 550 and 819 for that matter. But with that, I think I'll go ahead and end the discussion on those today and close the work session on Senate Bill 550. Dick, while you're here, we better go to 3632, open a work session on 3632, and we've got some amendments on that to look at this morning as well.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. There's a whole bunch of them. Gina. This goes on and on. Page 3, 5, 16, 5.
Okay, you want to walk us through?
Morning, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. Richard Yates with Legislative Revenue. House Bill 3632 basically deals with management of the state forest lands, which are the trust lands that are not part of the Common School Fund. And directs basically to and make the primary management principle, I guess, that of the production of valuable timber products and timber growth, and deals basically with directing forestry to revise its plan consistent essentially with the Forest Products Forest Product Practices Act, excuse me. You have this morning four amendments, I believe, to that bill.
2, 3, 4, and 5.
And speaking briefly to those amendments, two and three amendments you get to choose between, because the only difference between the two is whether or not you remove the material on page 2, line 42, where it speaks to part of the in the amending ORS 527-630 subsection 3. It says the purpose will be to encourage forest practices implementing the policy of, and then the policy is expressed in 527.610 to 527.770, and appended thereto are two penalty statutes, and so it doesn't make a lot of sense to talk about implementing policy in terms of penalty statutes, and that is there, and in talking with counsel, that is there because of the way the bill was originally drafted, which said that shall include sections 1 to 20 or whatever it was. And so they had the opportunity to clean it up, and that was counsel's change to take those out because it doesn't make much sense. But and the reaction by some of the testimony we had was that we were releasing or relaxing penalty provisions, but that's not true.
Yeah, so again, the dash 2s remove that reference to the penalty statute. I mean, actually maintain the deletion of the reference to the penalty statutes. And I think that was a concern that was raised in the last hearing on the bill, that by that perhaps we were relieving the some aspect of client compliance, or at least the penalty provisions. And then counsel explained that, in fact, that was not the intent or the effect, that those penalty statutes, in fact, just were not part of the policy that the text of the bill was referring to.
Correct.
And so
the council's opinion was that those penalty statutes were superfluous to the purpose of that language to begin with. And so the dash twos reflect that the dash threes reinstate those penalty
correct
statutes, so they essentially reinstate a superfluous reference to penalty statutes if people are more comfortable with that. So I guess that's our understand?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hatz.
I talked to council about that too, and I agree with their take on that. But if it did create confusion, then we should address it.
Okay.
And I think that's what they did.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. Did you address the section 4
no.
on both of these? Okay.
The balance of the two amendments are the same, and what they deal with is subsection 7, essentially, on page 3. And they broaden. The bill as drafted addresses the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests, and the amendment expand that to essentially include all of the lands acquired, which are the trust lands, under ORS 530 and other forest lands, except those common school forest lands in the Elliott State Forest, so that the policies of the bill, the direction to change management practices, would apply to all of those lands, not just the Tillamook and Clatsop Forest.
Okay.
Then the dash 4 amendments attach an emergency clause to the bill. The dash 5 amendments go back to section 1 and initially restore the original language in terms of the purpose, the dominant, looking for the word here, greatest permanent value language.
That's on line 8. Secure
yes.
the greatest permanent value.
They restore that language. But then over in section K, I think it is, subsection 2, which would be on page 3 of the amendments, they define secure the greatest permanent value.
Section K addresses the disease resistance.
Yes. Yeah, which is the same as the bill. It's just a little reorganization.
Mm-hmm.
But this is new language then, defining the greatest permanent value, and that is A, to encourage economically efficient forest practices that ensure the continuous growing and harvesting of forest tree species, and then B, to maintain forest land for the continuous growing and harvesting of forest tree species as a leading use consistent with a sound management of soil, air, water, fish, and wildlife resources.
Okay. And that language, Ray Wilkinson, do you want to come up and talk about some of these amendments? That language, as I understand, is actually drawn from the Forest Practices Act, the language that we see on page 3 of the dash 5 amendments. Ray, did you want to address these amendments?
Mr. Chairman, maybe just a couple comments. Ray Wilkinson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. What you just said is correct. The dash 5 amendments basically lift from ORS 527-630, the policy statement of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Those words have been on the books for a long time. They've served the state well in terms of forest policy. People are familiar with them. They know what the words mean, the leading use concept, but the, immediately followed by consistent with sound management of the environmental resources. So that is a probably a tighter way to get at the purpose of this bill than the original language on primarily and secondarily, and we believe it would send a clear message to the department and the Board of Forestry about what the legislative intent is. If I could make one other comment about the dash twos and threes, I may have missed it with Mr. Yates, but I think if I didn't, there's another effect of the dash two or three, and that is to eliminate on page 3 of the original bill, lines 10 and 11, which there was some comments from committee members the other day about that was a little bit too restrictive in terms of allowing practices that are above the minimum standards of the Forest Practices Act. On private forest land, typically, those minimum standards are exceeded, and so there's no reason not to allow that on state land as well. So both the twos and the threes would eliminate that sentence from the original bill.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Wilkinson while he's here? Representative Barnhart?
Thank you. One of the concerns I have about this is whether or not this really does allow the board to exceed the standards of the Forest Practices Act, and I guess maybe I'm asking, maybe I'm asking the wrong person, but as I look at these amendments, I'm not sure that we actually get there. We removed the explicit statement, but I wonder if it isn't lurking elsewhere in these amendments. And I'm not sure how I'm asking that of. Because of the reference because the reference in which it says shall be achieved through compliance with on 5 and 6 of the dash 2s and 7 and 8 of the dash 3s.
Mr. Chairman, I could comment on that if you'd like. And by way of example, perhaps, one of the issues we talked about during the public testimony was the stream buffers and the difference between what the Forest Practices Act requires and what the state is doing on the state lands. And on private land, the buffer widths range from 50 to 100 feet. On state lands, under the plan, they're 170 feet. With this bill, the buffer widths would be consistent with private land, 50 to 100 feet. But typically on private land, the minimum standards Forest Practices Act allows some removal of trees from the buffer width. If it's a 50-foot buffer, you don't have to leave all the trees. Depending on what you got to start with, there's a minimum volume requirement. Typically, though, a lot of private landowners decide not to do that, so they just leave all the trees. So it becomes a de facto no-cut area by choice of the landowner. This language would allow the state to do the same thing if they felt it was warranted on a particular stream. Say, even though the minimum standards would allow the purchaser of the timber sale to remove some of those trees, we don't think it's appropriate in this case, so we're going to say all those have to stay. So that's an example of the flex.
Another one we heard, I think, was reforestation. That landowner, private landowners,
Correct.
Often reforest greater density or a greater number of trees than is required under the Forest Practices Act.
That's correct.
And I guess my response, Representative Warner, that wouldn't be out of compliance with the Forest Practices Act to put in to reforest with more trees than it requires, or to leave more trees in the buffer than it requires.
Right.
I don't think there's anything lurking here.
Compliance is different than limited.
But that's right. Yeah, that's right.
And that was the problem with that sentence that the amendments would remove, and that's a good amendment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Again, if you go back to a private landowner, which is more like what we're getting at here, a private landowner would never be cited by the Board of Forestry for planting too many trees or leaving too many trees in a buffer or making the buffer too wide. So compliance really addresses the minimum standards and not the practices that might exceed that as appropriate under certain circumstances. Okay. That's my intent anyway in that language. Representative Farr, do you ever... Okay. What's the committee's pleasure with regard to the choice between the twos and the... Oh, I'm sorry, before we get to that, let's bring our friends from forestry up. Our forest friends. You've seen the amendments.
You have 10 minutes ago.
Okay. I'm
Steve Thomas with the Oregon Department of Forestry, Assistant State Forester. With me is Ross Holloway, Program Director for State Forest Land. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I just ask you basically if you've had any... if you have any immediate response or reflection on the amendments, particularly the amendment out of the language that is accomplished by the dash 2 and 3 amendments that takes out that language that says the board may not allow or require more restrictive standards, and then the dash 5 amendments that incorporate the language on from the Forest Practices Act.
Chair Cheverly, members of the committee, just again for the record, I'm Ross Holloway, the State Forest Program Director for the department. My reading of the language in the amendments in that regard, and we just had this discussion, would allow the board, my interpretation of it was allow our people on the ground to use their judgment and flexibility and possibly exceed a standard.
Right.
But I don't think it would allow the board to... continue with the current forest management plan, which specifies a higher standard. So that plan would have to be amended to comply with.
I think that's correct.
That's just information.
Yeah, I think that is
correct.
Everybody
needs to understand.
Representative Virgin?
Thank you. Yes, let me talk to you a little bit about that, because the county commissioner from Tillamook said that actually state land should have a higher standard. And I didn't pursue it at the time, and then later thought about it. Is there a reason that in the Forest Practices Act, in being compliant with any federal regulations or in working as a partner with any federal regulations, that you have that higher standard in the Forest Practices Act?
Representative, are you referring to the Forest Management Plan?
Right.
Having the higher standards in the Forest Practices
right.
Act. That particular standard was developed working off of the board's administrative rule defining greatest permanent value, which I think does specify a higher management goal than the intent of the Forest Practices Act. Specifically, it talks about providing habitat for all native species, providing for recreation, providing for a number of other values. And our assessment of that and our development of the strategies reflected that. And we did indeed construct riparian aquatic strategies that had, I'm not going to say higher standards, they had different standards than the Forest Practices Act for a number of reasons for those other resources. And they were an integrated set of strategies trying to provide for a number of things across the landscape. So for those reasons, they were constructed at a higher level. Now, this proposed legislation redefines greatest permanent value, and the board will have to amend that administrative rule to reflect that. And that will, they'll have a different finding to make about the package of strategies in the plan as to whether it meets that definition of greatest permanent value that they would now have.
Right. So I guess the bottom line is that the answer is no, wasn't it? It's not there as a for compliance or imposed by federal any requirement of federal law.
It was developed off the greatest permanent value
yeah.
rule.
Yeah, which is a state.
Right, and adopted by the board, yeah. not as part of a a federal process, but a state process.
Okay, and not in partnership in any way. In other words, I'm not getting the right answers. So I'm not asking the right questions. in other words, by looking at a bigger picture and involving more in the plan, that was strictly standards that the state felt like they should have, the state board, in putting the plan together. There were no other added things. There was no other partnership. There were no other federal requirements. There was no other benefit for the state by doing that.
Chair Shadley, Representative Berger, and members of the committee, concurrent with developing all those forest management plan strategies, we were talking with the federal agencies about a habitat conservation plan. My reading of the current definition of greatest permanent value, I believe the standard there is primarily what drove the strategies we have. And again, if those words change, we will need to look at it again in that context and say, what is the goal now that we're trying to achieve with those strategies? It will be different. We put that package together believing that it met that intent of greatest permanent value, and also, by doing that, would provide for those species to the extent that we ought to be successful in getting a habitat conservation plan and protection under the federal act from take prosecution. But I think if the federal ESA went away completely, those standards would still be appropriate to meet the current definition of greatest permanent value.
Okay. Dick, did you have occasion to do a new revenue impact statement, or can we accept it? It looks like your original revenue impact statement was pretty much congruent with the one that we got from Mr. Ivanoff, so that with the dash two or three amendments, we would be looking at revenue impact per biennium of 107 million some odd thousand. Is that right?
And that's what Mr. Ivanoff testified to.
And since his figure of 90 million is the same as yours, I assume there's a...
Well, I would much prefer that forestry provide a number, and if that number is something that they think is legitimate, that's the number I would use.
Okay. Do you... do you have any again, Mr. Ivanoff, using I think your department numbers developed a revenue impact based on this addition of the
Sandy M and West Oregon and Western Lane and Southwest Oregon districts. Again, the revenue impact of $107,400,000. Does that sound correct?
Chair Chardonnay, members of the committee, I'm not familiar. I think that was just extrapolated out with the additional acres. Again, I wasn't involved in that, so I don't know exactly how it was done. I can tell you that the threatened and endangered species issues on some of those other districts are much more constraining than they are on the Tillamook and Clatsop at this point, and it's less likely we could make those additional changes without some sort of coverage under the federal ESA. But okay. We're dealing with a margin of numbers there,
sure,
from 90 to maybe 100 or 105. So,
okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Hatt.
Thank you. Do any of these amendments ease your concerns about this bill?
Chair Shirley and Representative Hatt, members of the committee, yes, they do. I think the two primary issues for us as an agency and a program are amending the board's administrative rule, which will have to be done, and amending the forest management plan, which will be a long and, again, consuming process in terms of public input and review. It's an administrative rulemaking process, and that will have to be initiated and carried forward because the bill does fundamentally change several standards that are part and parcel of the current administrative rule that the board adopted, the forest management plan.
Mr. Chair, let me go down here, Representative Williams.
One of the questions I guess then I'd put to you, gentlemen, is do you anticipate that under, and assuming the bill passes with the amendments that have been proposed, and you do go through the process of amending your administrative rules and developing a new forest management plan, do you believe, though, that you still have the ability then within the statute to amend your forest management plan and go through that process in a manner that would still provide the same level of habitat protection that you're currently providing?
Chair Shetterly and Representative Williams, members of the committee, we would not be providing the same level of habitat on the landscape that we're proposing to provide. We would still protect the threatened and endangered species habitats that we have to under federal law. It doesn't affect that part of it. It would lessen the emphasis on providing habitat in the long term at the levels that we proposed in the forest management plan or were adopted in the forest management plan.
They're the levels that are over and above the ESA.
Well, Representative Shardley, the members of the committee, I might add one thing. What it would do is the concept was to, over time and across the landscape, be able to create enough habitat that there would not be a need for an HCP on state forest habitat conservation plan, so that it wouldn't be necessary to manage spot by spot for these species, but rather to create a forest that would allow us to operate throughout the forest versus managing site by site, species by species. That's been the construct in which this was built and then the HCP developed. So this approach would probably limit your older forest structure, not necessarily in blocks of acreage or locations that may be conducive to that sort of approach, and it would be more or less along stream bottoms and recreational areas and those portions of the land that would probably be left for older complex structure, but not necessarily the same format that we had thought of before when we put this together.
And in terms of amending the forest management plan, I know things are always more complicated than they seem from here, but doesn't this bill essentially give you the template, and that is the Forest Practices Act? Isn't that essentially the template that this bill directs be implemented for forest management purposes? So we're not just saying go off and come up with something else. We've actually provided the template, which is the Forest Practices Act. Shouldn't that make it easier to amend the forest management plan, since we've actually directed a template which is already in statute and familiar with all the players?
Representative Shetterly, members of the committee, I would agree that the more language we have, it provides an easier opportunity for us to try to figure out what that means.
Right.
Again, I think there will still be some need for discussion and public process that goes through, and that in itself takes time, and so they'll have a framework from which to operate. But it's still a process that needs to go through, and public needs to be involved, and shareholders need to be involved. So it'll still take time, but yes, language is more definitive.
Sure. Representative Werner?
You're talking about public process and time. I really have two questions. The first one is, have you provided us with the current definition of those magic words, which I now can't find.
Permanent.
Greatest permanent value. Based on your administrative rule, do we have that language somewhere? Have we gotten it?
We can provide that, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee. We can provide that to you. I don't believe it was provided in our initial testimony.
I'd be curious as to how that's different from what we're proposing to adopt in the amendments. And so that would be of great interest to me. The second issue I wanted to ask you about was how long it will take, if assuming this bill were adopted with the dash fives, I guess we're talking about, to get to a new management plan and to get to the increased cut that Mr. Ivanoff is talking about. Are we talking about a couple of years or 6 months? Or
before you answered, that was one of my. I was the one who requested the dash threes. The dash four is the emergency clause to get this thing jump started, so we didn't have to wait until January 1 to get that started. So yeah, assuming an emergency clause.
So assuming sometime in the next few months this bill becomes law, then how long would it take for the process that you were describing a minute ago?
Representative Shetterly, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, I'll take a stab at that, and I'm sure Ross will fill in. Basically, right now, we are currently just approved the fiscal year 04 timber sale plan, and people are working on the 05 timber sale plan. Many of the sales we survey prior to deciding whether they're going to be into a sale plan 2 years prior to naming them and identifying them, just to ensure that we don't have a threatened endangered species issue. So if we said today we're going to add more volume, we're going to have to look for areas that either don't have threatened endangered species issues, or it could possibly be 2 to 3 years down the road before you actually see that increased volume through the planning process. And in addition, that's just the operational end of putting timber sales up. And then the revenue from that flows depending on the length of the contract. Once you sell it, you've got typically a 2 to 3 year contract after that, and the revenue flows in that 2 to 3 year period after the sale is sold. So if you turned on the faucet today, the minimum you'd probably see would be a 2 to 3 year increase, and that would be for a sale that's pretty straightforward, no threatened endangered species, not a lot of road construction or project work, to somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 6 years before you'd see the revenue flow. Ross, may I have some amendments to that?
I'd concur with that assessment. On the issue of how quickly the administrative rule and the plan can be amended, again, those are administrative rulemaking processes. The board does have the authority for emergency rulemaking, which can happen quite rapidly. And I would think that we'd probably look at that. If the legislation becomes effective immediately, we'd have to look at that and then probably follow with the more formal rulemaking process to sort out all the details of what needs to be amended in the rule. But Steve's point on the timing operationally on the ground is a good one. It's pretty rapid to have the revenue flowing 2 years from the time you start saying you're going to have more volume on the market.
So the follow-up then, it sounds to me from what you're saying as though we should not expect additional revenue in the biennium that we're studying now, the one starting month after next.
Chair Shetterly and Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, that's exactly what we put in our fiscal impact statement, was no additional revenue in the 03-05 biennium and then starting to flow in the 05-07, just because of the timing of these sale preparation tasks that we have to undertake, particularly the T&E survey, and that's the key one.
Other comments, questions? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ross, I've heard you say if this were to pass, you would have to do some extensive revisions to the forest management plan. Could you talk to us a little bit about ongoing revisions, the form in which they occur, and the stakeholders who participate in those decisions and those thoughts and processes?
Chair Shirley and Representative Hobson, members of the committee, the plan was only adopted 2 years ago, and the implementation plans were just approved, so we haven't made any revisions to date in the forest management plan. Typically, we work with the one formal advisory committee that we work with is the Forest Trust Land Advisory Committee, representing the trust land counties. The board's administrative rule, which defines greatest permanent value, also specifies a process for forest management planning. and the plan itself specifies what parameters would constitute, you know, major amendments to that. And the changes we're talking about here affect three of the core strategies of the forest management plan: the stand structures and the targets for those structures that are in the plan, the standards for structural elements like snags and downwood, which would have to be the forest practices standards, and the aquatic and riparian standards. So those three core strategies would have to be amended. And again, the process for that is specified in the board's administrative rule. It involves public meetings, public outreach, as well as work with the county advisory committee.
But again, we've given you a little guidance in the bill where we say the Forest Practices Act will be the template for the plan.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. That narrows the strategy provisions, but there's still major amendments to the existing plan.
Representative Shetterly, Representative Hobson, members of the committee, I might add that there is an ongoing work in progress right now working with the counties on one particular issue, and that is harvest levels. We have put together a work plan. As you heard previously, there was a concern over the harvest levels that came out of the forest management plan and subsequent implementation plans. And the counties hired Mason, Bruce, and Gerard as a consultant to work with us. And we have been working with them and currently have a work plan, a two-year work plan in process to come up with some better data and better figures to see something we can all sink our teeth into a little bit better. And that's about a two-year work plan that we're currently working on. And Mason, Bruce, and Gerard is on that task force as representing the counties as a consultant. So there is some ongoing work going on right now to continue to look at the plan. And lastly, I would say that one of the main constructs of this plan was, in order to fully implement it, we needed to have a strong adaptive management strategy, monitoring, and research strategy. We recently had that reviewed by Hal Salwasser, Dean of the Oregon State University, and he commended us. He certainly recommended some changes to our effort, but he did commend us as probably one of the better adaptive management plans that have been developed in the Pacific Northwest, and that we are testing the hypothesis. We do have monitoring in place, and we do have research projects in place to ensure that the premises on which we built this plan are valid, and if they're not valid, are there any changes that need to be made? So that is an ongoing piece of this plan that has been part of it all along and indicates this ongoing change and modification that I believe Representative Hobson may have been mentioning or concerned about.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Ivanoff, if you can come forward, and if you want to bring a friend along with you. Question about the work that you did on the analysis, the $107 million that you reflected as the revenue from the amendment that would emanate from the Dash 2 or Dash 3 amendments. Do you want to address that?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Chair Shetterly and members of the committee. I'm Dave Ivanoff, Vice President of Resources for Hampton Affiliates. Basically, what I did is I took a look at the land base that is occupied by the other districts encompassed under the forest management plan, talked with foresters in the Eugene area. They're familiar with the site quality in those areas, and determined that the incremental volume on an annual basis would be 29 million board feet a year on that land base, which is easily doable, both from my experience as a professional forester and from other individuals that are practicing foresters in the Eugene and Southern Oregon areas. And it was just a product of the stumpage rate of $300 a thousand. The other thing I would like to point out, too, is that the revenue impact statement is predicated around an average stumpage rate of $300 a thousand. And I would like to point out to the committee that I believe that that's a conservative number. And the reality is that harvest levels, volume per acre removed under this kind of a forest management plan will reduce logging costs and increase stumpage rates. The way an appraisal is conducted, we start out with a delivered log value at our sawmill, and we subtract the cost of production, and the resulting number is the stumpage, and that's what the number that we use to bid the sale. With lower production costs, the average stumpage rate would likely go up above the $300 a thousand, which again is slightly less than what the department realized from the sale of state timber on the three North Coast districts in fiscal 2002. I would like to also address the issue relative to the timing of the incremental revenue stream that would occur under this plan. In private meetings with the department and with key staff on your committee, I've indicated that the industry is operating in a hand-to-mouth type scenario right now. We are bringing logs great distances from the state of Washington because there's a shortage of raw material right in our backyard. Mm-hmm. We've had layoffs in the Eugene area. Seneca Sawmill laid off a third shift down there recently. Roseburg Forest Products has reduced capacity down there again because of raw material shortages. I would respectfully suggest that if this committee and the governor suggested that we wanted a more rapid response, there are areas where T&E species or threatened endangered species issues are not a concern, and that is in those young stands affected by Swiss needlecast. I strongly believe that with shorter-term timber sales, those sales would be purchased and harvested in an immediate fashion, and there would be a much more rapid flow of revenue than what the department staff indicated this morning. Again, that's my perspective on it. And as a major purchaser of state timber, I think that if the others were here that testified at your original hearing, they would also agree that we need raw material immediately. With that, I wouldn't have any more to offer right now, sir. Okay.
Thank you very much. You that was sort of another purpose in my request of the for the emergency clause in this. One, of course, is to just the function that emergency clause serves in making a bill effective upon passage so that we can move down the road to get this implemented sooner. But the other, I think, is a recognition of nothing short of an emergency, I think, in our natural resources, the timber industry, and recognizing that while we do want to maintain protection for environment, for species, we do have, I think, the responsibility in the legislature to also recognize the nature of our economic situation right now and an industry that we neglected, I think, substantially for the past 20 years in the expectation, I think, perhaps that high-tech was going to lead us into a brave new world and looking now that, in fact, maybe we do need to maintain a more diversified industrial and economic base in this state. And we need to do it quickly because mills are closing and people are losing jobs, and as a result of that, we're losing revenues. And there's an emergency here that goes just beyond the technical nature of an emergency clause, I think, in this bill. So I thank you for your comments about the hand-to-mouth nature of the industry right now and the job loss. One question I have, in the dash twos and threes, we know where the Clatsop and Tillamook forests are. Can you just tell us geographically where these other forest lands are that we're talking about?
The other areas encompassed under the Northwest and Southwest Forest Management Plan include areas owned by the Department of Forestry in the Santiam area, the Santiam State Forest. It's east of Lyons. There's a significant block of ownership it's called the West Oregon District, managed out of Philomath. The Santiam land base is about 48,000 acres. The West Oregon District is about 38,000 acres rounded. And then there's a district called the Western Lane District that's managed out of Veneta, and that's about 26,000 acres. And then in Southwest Oregon, lands outside the Elliott State Forest occupy about 18,000 acres. So the total land base is about 634,000 acres, and the three North Coast districts, Astoria, Forest Grove, and Tillamook, are about 500,000 acres. So you've got about another 134,000 acres with the addition.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Farr.
Thank you. I just a brief statement. I would hope that the people of Oregon trust to adopt the implementing rules understand the emergency that we're in as far as the economy in the state and as you state, the hand-to-mouth nature of the industry, and that If things can be expedited inside of this 2 to 3 year plan, then certainly the people of Oregon want those things expedited.
Anything else? Normally, I'm one who is loath to. I give deference and strong deference to agency expertise and their authority. And I'll tell you, if this was the choice in this committee of us designing a Forest Practices Act, we wouldn't be hearing this bill because we don't have the capacity to do that. In this case, I see this more as a choice of legislative policy, though. We already have a Forest Practices Act that has been developed through the agency and is a template for sound forest management. We're not creating that. We're just saying, as with this bill, as a matter of legislative policy, we want to go more in that direction because that protects the environment, it protects species, but it also provides an opportunity for enhanced productive capacity for jobs and revenue to the state. And I think that's a fair legislative policy decision to make. It's not a matter of us creating our own forest policy or Forest Practices Act here. That's way beyond our expertise, but I think it is within our purview as a legislature to make that policy decision that we would rather move in the direction of this already established and fully vetted management philosophy and practice than this other. And so that's why I, for one, who usually am strongly deferential to agencies in their area of expertise, and willing and strongly inclined to go this direction, because again, I think we're not really infringing on that expertise so much as we are just saying that as a matter of policy, we want to go with this particular management plan that the agency itself has had a lead role in developing for the management of private forest lands. Comments? Committee, what is your... Thank you, Mr. Ivanov.
What's
your pleasure with regard to the -2s or -3s? Do we want to leave in that... superfluousness for everyone's comfort and
Chair, to the extent that being superfluous makes people comfortable, I think we ought to leave it in.
All right, I'll take that as a motion to adopt the dash threes then to House Bill 3632. Is there discussion on the dash threes? Any objection?
No.
Pardon?
No.
No. Okay. Dash threes are in. Chair would move the dash fours. That's the emergency clause. Is there any discussion on that? Any objection?
Yes.
Okay. One objection, Representative Hobson. Representative Barnhart. Two objections on the dash fours. Thank you. They are in. What do we want to do with the dash fives, committee? Representative Parr?
It seems to me that the dash fives... go a long way to ease some people's alarm about this particular bill. And with that, I would move the dash five.
Okay. Representative Farr moves the dash fives then into House Bill 3632. Again, recognizing then that incorporates the policy language from the existing Forest Practices Act and makes it applicable to state forest lands. Any discussion on the dash five amendments? Objections? How did I know? Two objections to the dash five amendments. Dash fives are in. Does that take care of the amendments?
It does.
All right. Chair then would move House Bill 3632 as amended by the dash threes, dash fours, and dash fives to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on that? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you read my mind so well, you looked right at me.
Yeah. No, I saw a movement out of my peripheral vision.
I will be voting no against this, and as most of you can imagine, it's somewhat difficult vote because I would love to see an increase in jobs in Tillamook and Clatsop counties since I represent them. However, the basis for my opposition to this is both in regard to the plan that's been set up. I think we went through a long and somewhat arduous process of setting this up, and I hate to use the vernacular, but all the stakeholders were at the table. Granted, it may not have turned out exactly as everybody wanted, but I think that's the value of the plan as well, in that there is inherent in that an opportunity for some adjustments due to unforeseen circumstances. So I'm against it just on that basis, but I also think that we have information from the people intimately involved in this. We have a letter from the Clatsop commissioners saying they oppose it. The Forest Trust Lands Commission has not taken a position on this, and it seems to me if it really felt that good to everybody involved and it was such a good idea, that group that would benefit the most and represents the conglomeration, if you will, of the counties involved would also be voting for it. And another part to this, and again going back to the original part with the development of the plan with all the stakeholders, the, and for lack of a better descriptive word, the small insurrection we had from the conservationist groups, what, 2 years ago, in Tillamook and Clatsop County, I know for a fact that that cost Tillamook County over $50,000 to take care of the tree sitters that were there. I don't have the figures for Clatsop, but I can't imagine that it was any less for them. And that was a somewhat smaller demonstration, and those are the kinds of costs that will have to be borne by the counties. The county even ended up paying for some medical, I shouldn't use my facial expressions, I've been told I shouldn't play poker, but the county ended up paying for medical costs for people who were injured as they were tree sitting. And I think we're opening up a can of worms. I also believe that the department has heard loudly and clearly, even from people such as me who will defend the forest management plan, that maybe we do need to take a look at this, and particularly with Swiss Neelcast, if there are opportunities to increase the harvest there without running into ESA problems, that they should indeed go in that direction. So for all of those reasons, I will be a no.
Okay. Hey, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hobson and I think agree on certainly on all the things that she has said. One of the most telling points for me in looking at this, well, actually there's several, but one of the really important ones is that the people closest to this issue on the ground who are not connected with the agency itself, the county commissioners, are at least split on this issue completely. And when you realize that they would benefit very directly in their operations from increase in the timber harvest, I find that a very telling point, that they would be split in the way they are on this sort of a measure. I'm also very concerned about the issue that was raised by the Tillamook County Commissioner, whose name escapes me right at the moment.
The one that supported it or the one that opposed
the
it?
The one who opposed the measure. We have
Tim Josie.
Thank you. Mr. Josie, we have a very serious political problem in dealing with our forests in Oregon. The locus of that problem is mostly in Washington, D.C., not in Oregon, because, of course, so much of the forest land that ought to be part of our economic base, it's controlled by the federal government. I'm impressed by the plans of the State Board of Forestry to conduct good scientific research and planning in these forests that we control. I think it's going to be very important, if we're going to ever break the political logjam that we have in Washington between those who want to cut trees and those who want to protect the forest and can't talk to each other. The most important thing we can do is to get good scientific information and do good scientific planning in our forests so that we can be in a position to broker the kinds of political changes that will be needed in Washington, D.C. in order to get access, reasonable and appropriate access, to the federal forests. Now, of course, everyone knows that those forests are substantially larger than the ones that we control and have a potential for providing substantially more income to the state, maybe not to our budget directly, but certainly indirectly to our budget. Finally, the last point, it has to do with the timing of this. We need funds now. I think it's become apparent that this approach is not likely to produce much income right now. In the next biennium, because of the delays necessary in the process that we've already heard from. And I guess I had one more final point. I really would like to see a very clear explanation of their plan to harvest the diseased timber. If in fact we have timber that's not growing because of disease, And if it's possible to reasonably harvest that at a faster rate than the current plan, I think they ought to go ahead and do that. But I'm not willing at this point to second-guess the State Board of Forestry. I think that we've scared them, but good with this bill. And if there are changes that they can make that will increase the cut within the management plan that they have, I suspect they'll do it.
Representative Farr, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very briefly.
Yeah.
This bill really doesn't preclude scientific planning of the forest. In fact, it seems to me that it encourages it. Particularly with the Dash 5 amendments, I think we're addressing most of the concerns that folks have. And what we really have to understand and what we have to realize is that we are in an emergency state and emergency position in the state right now. And 2 years is too long. You know, we need to move faster than that. We need to get things on the ground as quickly as possible. And I don't think that we need to be delaying 2 years. And even if that were the case, we have to get things started as quickly as possible. So I hope we move forward with this thing immediately.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you live long enough, you see the pendulum swing from one way to another. And I grew up here in this valley and spent half my childhood in Tillamook County and have watched our forests kind of diminish along the way in a sort of a shock and awe way. When I was a child, forests just disappeared. They'd be there, and then they'd be gone, and a lot of forest land had disappeared. And then at some point we said, oh, stop, halt, and we did stop, halt. And we just absolutely stop, halted, and said we're not going to... There was, I think, a philosophy that these trees are just going to be saved forever and not good thinking into their purpose. We need to strike a balance. I think this does strike a balance. I like this language put in here in the dash fives about the sort of definition of secure the greatest permanent value. These are our forests. They are a resource of the whole state. I think they can be managed in some ways that serve both needs, but we need to make a clear policy statement to the Forestry Department as to what the direction we are looking, and I think this does this. So I'm definitely going to support this as a sort of a balance to get us back to harvesting the forests again in a reasonable way, not the shock and awe way that I saw as a child.
Anybody else? I just wanted to respond to Representative Barnhart in your comment about the revenue and this being not forthcoming for the next biennium. That may be, I hope that we've impressed on the department that our hope that by giving the department the template of the Forest Practices Act that it should be easier and not so difficult perhaps to move on some of these sales that Mr. Ivanov suggested could be done more quickly, that in fact we could speed the revenue stream on this thing because there is a sense of urgency about this. By the same token, I don't see this as being necessarily a budget fix for a biennium. This is long term. The intent of this, of course, is sustainable harvest, which to me means on a permanent basis. And those jobs and that revenue will be just as important 2 years from now, 4 years from now, 10 years from now, if we manage it under the Forest Practices Act. And, you know, if there comes a time when we find that the Forest Practices Act is deficient for the long-term maintenance of a sustainable yield and all of the balanced priorities in managing forest land, then we really need to address that for the 10 million acres of private land that the Forest Practices Act covers, as well as 600,000 acres of state forest land. And I think it's appropriate to move these under a more common management system. And then if changes need to be made, then we need to make those changes across the landscape and not just in 600,000 acres of state forest land. And I guess with that, anybody else? We're running out of time, but I don't want to. This is important, and I'm happy to have the discussion. Anybody else? Okay, then please call the roll, Kathy.
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Berger?
Aye.
Farr?
Yes.
Hass?
Yes.
Hobson?
No.
Scott?
Yes.
Berger?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes. Aye. So House Bill 3632 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. You want to carry it?
No.
Oh.
Mr. Chair, I think you can carry this.
Okay.
What I would like to do is give notice of a possible minority report.
Okay. Thank you very much. Chair will carry the bill. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3632. And very briefly, committee, since we are almost out of time, I want to open the work session on House Bill 2652. We have John McIntosh, who drove over from Bend, it looks like, to speak to us on this. I want to make sure we get his testimony, and we'll go as far as we can on this in about 10 minutes of time, and then we'll have to adjourn for a floor session.
Great. Thank you very much for your attention.
Sure. Mr. McIntosh, you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. John McIntosh, Cascade Sunworks is my company. We're a general contractor in Bend, Oregon. We got our business started in April 2002. We're five employees. I wanted to share some successes so we could understand the impact that potentially that this amendment has to this bill.
You know, I'm sorry, Mr. McIntosh, we haven't heard that amendment. If you want to address what the amendment is.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Okay. What I'm trying to help you accomplish is to change the extension or make an extension to the tax credits for solar photovoltaic systems so that customers who install larger scale systems, 2,000 watts, have an opportunity to take advantage of up to 4 years of a tax credit to obtain up to $6,000 of offset to the installation of their system. Today, the systems that I install typically are in the 500 to 600 watts, and customers are not installing larger scale systems. We do both solar hot water and photovoltaics. In the last year, we've done 18 solar hot water systems. We've done one photovoltaic system. We need some help to get this side of the business up and running and going and to be successful with it. I asked the Office of Energy to give me an idea of the cost of this tax credit program, and for the next biennium, it's less than $30,000 reduction in state revenue with a potential increase in PV installation investments of $3 million. So that's a 100-to-1 impact for spending $27,000 to get $3 million in new photovoltaic system investments. That's important. Both to our economy, to my business personally, to the solar business in general in Oregon, and to have some substantial impacts on our environment and to do the right thing for our residents. Those are the scope of my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we ask Michael Rainey to come up quickly, Michael, and we'll have you back too when this comes up, but I want to make sure that you orient us to... Oh, you want to go ahead and stay there.
Oh, all right.
Mr. McIntosh, since you drove all this way, we'll let you spend a little more time at the desk. Michael, we're talking about which amendments here?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the Dash 8s. And for the record, Mike Rainey from the Oregon Office of Energy.
Dash 8.
Yeah, it's the thick one. It's part of the Dash 8s.
Okay. Let's find that. I looked at the Dash 8s and I saw on the first page, yeah, including use in confined animal feeding operation. I knew that's what wasn't what Mr. McIntosh was talking about.
The energy provisions are in.
Yeah, I understand. So that just incorporates the existing bill.
The energy provisions are in the latter half of the bill, and the solar provisions in particular are towards the very end of the bill. And the amendments actually do a number of things to encourage.
Okay, looks like we're on page 30.
And
no, before that even.
Well, the amendments have about four things on energy.
Okay.
Pat Egan from the governor's office asked me to mention, too, that these are provisions that the governor's office is very interested in, both in terms of economic development and encouraging renewable resources. The provisions would first amend the business energy tax credit that currently exists, that's a 35% tax credit for energy conservation and renewable resources, to increase for renewable resources only the amount up to 50%. And it would also allow businesses that establish facilities that produce components for renewable resources, like wind, solar, silicon chips, biomass energy facilities to qualify for that tax credit as well. It would allow a person to take advantage of business tax credit without having to offset any federal production tax credit they receive, which current law requires. That would allow them to accept both the pollution control and the state business energy tax credit. And then in addition, it would address the change that Mr. McIntosh addressed, which is increasing the residential tax credit for solar electric only, which and solar photovoltaic electrics is much more expensive than other renewable resources for residential. And it would allow up to $1,500 a year over 4 years for a maximum of $6,000 based on the efficiency of the system, whereas currently the maximum for residential use of solar is $1,500. And that's what the amendments do, at least in terms of the energy amendments, and we support those as well.
Okay. And when we have a chance to get this back up again, you'll be back in.
Yes.
We can look at those in more detail.
Right.
All right. Any questions for Mr. McIntosh, since he's here and probably won't be back when we hear this again? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm not sure this is even remotely related to what you know about, but one of the big problems we have with electricity is the peak power production, which is the most expensive part of power production. Would these systems have any effect on peak power?
Is that your question?
Yes.
Certainly, inherently, a solar photovoltaic system is at peak production in the middle of the summer. We have our longest days, and when the sun is the brightest, and that's when our photovoltaic systems are producing the most energy. They produce the least energy in the winter months. We have about 2.9 hours of sun a day on average in the winter. Almost 10 in the summer.
Yeah. Well, if I could follow up, what I'm really asking is, do you know how that thing you just stated compares to the actual peak demand times for the use of electricity, and whether or not this then would have the effect of chopping the tops off of the demand, or simply take the place of electricity that is being produced at times when demand is low?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I think this bill would help in a general way by diversifying our resources. To the extent that wind and solar give us additional resources for electricity production, while the Northwest has traditionally had a winter electric peak and California and the Southwest a summer electric peak, the two regions have become much more integrated. And we saw in the last few years when California has problems, the whole region has problems. So to the extent that we're able to get increased clean energy from solar and wind, really any time of the year, there would be a market for it. And it would help our regional stability as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you. I'm glad we had a chance to get you in to testify, Mr. McIntosh. Mr. Rainey, always good to see you. With that, committee, we're up to the end of our time for this morning, so I will close the work session on House Bill 2652, and we'll get that back up. Elizabeth, Can we next time, can we have a matrix on these amendments now?
Yeah.
We have enough, but I think we need a score sheet. And they're coming in from all over the over the building. Okay? All right. Committee, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.